You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of October 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, the former British Prime Minister concedes what many have been claiming for years. The mistakes made in Iraq led to the rise of what we now call the Islamic State.
I can also apologise, by the way, for some of the mistakes in planning and certainly our mistake in our understanding of what would happen once you removed the regime.
So what did Tony Blair actually apologise for? And is the world really safer post Saddam Hussein? I'll ask my studio guests, Raffaello Pantucci and Daniela Peled. Also ahead, Russia is said to be lurking suspiciously close to a bunch of vital underwater cables that make the internet work. And it's got the US worried. What are they up to? Also, we look at the bizarre case of a man who travelled from Israel to Syria by way of a paraglider. And when it comes to politics, is it time to do away with the role of the First Lady? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to Midori House. And my guests today are Raffaello Pantucci, who's Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and Daniela Peled, who's the editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both to the programme. Now, we're going to start with that story about former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Now, he's well acquainted with some criticism over his handling of Britain's role in the Iraq War, but only now, during an interview with CNN, has he gone so far as to apologise. During the recorded interview, which hasn't been broadcast yet, Mr Blair said that he and other leaders who played a role in removing Saddam Hussein held some form of responsibility for the current state of Iraq. But he was careful in his wording, clarifying that if Saddam had not been dealt with, today's Iraq might look a lot like Syria. But as many analysts noted, his most telling response came after a question on the so-called Islamic State. When asked if Britain's actions in Iraq led to the rise of the terrorist group, Mr Blair conceded that there are elements of truth to that. Daniela, is he right?
He's definitely right about that. But I think it's an intensely annoying reading of recent history to say that there's a direct line between the invasion of Iraq and the rise of ISIS as they are today. There's definitely a contributing factor, but there is a multiplicity of other factors. One could argue that Obama's desire to get out of Iraq and wash his hands off the whole thing also contributed to it, because it allowed Maliki to continue his sectarian policy. So it would be very easy to say, well, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, and that's all that is responsible for it, but that's just not the case.
Raffaello, obviously he's keen to kind of clean up his legacy here a little bit, but before we dive into that, the very notion of ISIS was intriguing, I guess, we have these two really stark neighbouring examples. We have Iraq, where, yes, we went in, we intervened, the West meddled, and Syria, where we've done nothing at all, and we've allowed a kind of homegrown revolution to kind of fester and not really get anywhere. And we have ISIS in both places. So intervention or non-intervention, as Daniel said, it isn't quite clear-cut what the cause is.
Well, I mean, the cause of ISIS is certainly not linked directly to the 2003 invasion. It goes back long before. It's an organization which had existed since the late 1990s, when it was founded somewhere in Afghanistan, and then migrated in the wake of the 2001 invasion of Afghanistan up to sort of northern Iraq, and then spread down from there to become a player in the insurgency. The group that we see is really one that crosses both of these borders, and, a lot of the sort of reasons behind its growth are as much to do with the sort of bad governance that you had on the ground in the form of the Assad regime, the Saddam regime arguably before, and then now the sort of the very sectarian policies of the Maliki regime. So there's a lot of different reasons that go into it, and this is a group that existed for a long time before that. It's sort of odd that Tony Blair decides to say that there is elements of truth in in the sort of decision to go in 2003 having some link to it today? Well, there is some sort of a link likely there, but it's not, you know, it's not a sort of conclusive, the genesis of the organization is that particular invasion. It's far, far more complicated than that.
And Daniel, he's not backing off on the notion that actually sometimes it's good to remove bad people from power. He doesn't seem to say that it was wrong to move Saddam Hussein. In fact, as we said in the introduction, he points out that, you know, it could have been sectarian, it could have been like Syria if they hadn't removed that man.
Well, he can't back away from it completely. No. I mean, that would remove virtually his whole raison d'etre. In any case, his apology is a kind of strange confection, because it doesn't go quite far enough to say, look, hands up, I'm sorry about the whole thing, I was wrong. It's a bit more passive-aggressive in the way that he would say, well, I'm sorry, somebody says, I'm sorry you feel that way, and I'm sorry that you were offended.
But don't you think that morally, you know, he, even for himself, if he said, OK, it's my responsibility, everything went wrong, that would be, you know, the deaths of British servicemen, the deaths of all sorts of people. He's never going to be able to come to that kind of position. Or he would be open to the charges that other people have tried to lay at his door.
Yeah, absolutely. And his apology is... I'm not directly affected by this, but his apology is effectively meaningless. For the families of the bereaved on, you know, Britain and Iraq, it doesn't go far enough. But it could never go far enough unless he rocked up to The Hague himself and said, you know, take me in. There's no apology. I mean, this is about perhaps sort of manipulation and trying to lay the ground ahead of the Chilcot report. But even that, I mean, there's nothing that he could say that would go... far enough. And the current, the way he's seen in British politics right now, nothing he could say could really remove his original sin.
But I do think he could stop saying things. You know, he does continue to sort of appear in these sorts of interviews, and this does just sort of exacerbate it further. I mean, around the Chilcot inquiry, when it finally comes out with this report, I'm sure we're going to get a whole new flurry of these sorts of stories and articles, and none of them are really going to resolve anything, you know, and we still are going to be in the situation that we are. The conflict has happened, the people have died, and, you know, there's a general admission which you can find across intelligence agencies, governments from the time that says the intelligence was wrong about why we went in there, and that's kind of it. But we are where we are today. And so I don't necessarily know if there's much help and much benefit to this sort of consistent dragging up of these old stories. And if I look at the leaders that were involved in that in particular, and look at George Bush, we haven't seen a huge amount of him, frankly, since he stepped out of office. So I think there is a way of stepping back from these things which one could do. And I think Tony Blair has clearly made a bit of a decision to not necessarily do that in some of these cases.
And you know, to be fair to the man, do you think there's some kind of, you know, there's a bit of manoeuvring here? Because let's remember, when that attack happened, when we went to war, when we invaded, he wasn't the only person saying we should do it. There was a reasonably broad consensus of people who felt that, you know, Saddam Hussein was probably harboring chemical weapons, that something needed to be done. But now we've kind of managed to kind of clean up this whole story, right, where suddenly he's the only person that's carrying the can. There were all sorts of other people who believed in that invasion.
And look, he was re-elected after the Iraq War. It's not like the British people decided, OK, this is you've gone too far. I think we are very, very confused about the situation now in Iraq and Syria. It's horribly complicated and it's horribly frightening. And it would be much easier to draw a direct line from one action right to the current situation, where there aren't any easy answers, there aren't any...
I want to loop back to that in 1 second, but just on this notion before we leave Mr. Blair, you know, legacy, do you feel that, you know, in 10 years' time, 20 years' time, we may look back at him with a bit more respect? Because, you know, we've forgotten all the, you know, the things that he did do. He was, you know, really consistent on supporting the national health, and he did some other good things in the UK, you know, on the domestic scene. But his whole character has been really kind of besmirched by this terrible incident.
He hasn't helped himself by what he's done post his premiership. You know, George Bush retired fairly gracefully from the scene, but he's, you know, in a consultancy, earning enormous amounts of money, doing rather kind of dodgy deals, and wanting, you know, his role in the Middle East as the quartet's envoy was, you know, it was really derided very, very widely. But I think you're right. I think history will judge him a lot more fairly than he's being judged now.
And let's be honest, Bill Clinton earns a lot more money than Tony Blair, I'm sure. Yeah. And you know, we don't tell him off for kind of, you know, going on the speaker circuit.
It's not the British way, though.
But I think also the other thing is wait until the next election when the Labour Party has probably trounced in the polls, and then there will be an awful lot of looking back with sort of rose-tinted glasses.
The final thing on this, you know, this, which is this notion of what happens if you do invade, if you do attack a country, because we've seen the same story kind of unfolding in Libya. was it wrong that he removed Saddam Hussein, or what was more wrong, that they didn't have some path to what would happen afterwards? So they kind of destroyed the Ba'ath Party, but they didn't kind of have then anybody who could run the military machine, who could run the ministries. And it seems to me that we're stuck with a model of 1945 Europe, where you can destroy the Nazi Party and you put in a few good men who miraculously turned that country around and it didn't fall apart. By the 1950s, you have a kind of booming democracy, a booming economy. And somehow that template applied to Iraq doesn't kind of work, and applied to Libya. You find a few nice Democrats, they can't run it on their own. It just feels that we're stuck with the 1945 model.
But I think the point is that there isn't one model to do this sort of a thing. If you actually think back to the war, the Second World War and the defeat of Germany, it was a slow conflict that really ground across German territory, slowly crushing cities and destroying armies and cities and everything else. And that was a process that went over a long time. So finally, what you had left was essentially a completely shattered country. With Iraq, the invasion was actually very quick. They went in very quickly, decapitated the regime, decided to disband the Ba'ath Party, and suddenly left all these unemployed people with guns, no salaries, no prospects, and just sort of chaos. In Libya, the situation was different. There you had a situation where you had a tribal country essentially held together by one man who, using sort of his force of will, maintained a sort of balance amongst these tribes. And some of them were still fighting against him. And then you just sort of removed him and didn't offer an alternative instead. So in each of these contexts, it's very different. So I don't think that the model that we used back in the Second World War is really a useful comparison in some ways. And I think thinking in those terms didn't necessarily help. I think each of these conflicts is always going to be different. I don't think we're ever going to do it. The fact that we hadn't prepared for the post-conflict reconstruction is a huge, huge mistake in Iraq, and one that I think we're still suffering the consequences of.
Well, we're going to move on, because now, as one might expect, insider details of what the Pentagon and US spy agency discuss remains behind an ironclad wall of secrecy. However, many officials have confirmed, in what the New York Times calls broad terms, that there are growing concerns over Russia's allegedly suspicious activity close to a set of crucial underwater fiber optic cables. The issue has proven serious enough to prompt Norway to ask its neighbours for aid in tracking Russian submarines. During the Cold War, many worried over Russia's ability to tap into the cables. But with that skill long ago mastered by the US, officials now fear the Kremlin may be planning to sever the cables should tensions ever rise too high. Do you think this is a likely story? And it's intriguing, Daniel, because, this is, out of sight, and huge networks of cables. And we would like to Google something. We wouldn't be able to do the show, I tell you, without the
internet.
Absolutely,
absolutely. It's a wonderful story. I mean, it's got all the elements, the sort of apocalyptic danger, the idea of breaking the internet, which is, terrifying for all of us. But I think the real power of the story, and I'm sure there's a great amount of truth in it, really, it plays into Russia's hybrid war on all fronts, which is the psychological war, this part of it, the media war. I mean, this is a frightening, frankly terrifying prospect, and it does Russia no harm at all for the West to be discussing, rather breathlessly, that it's poised to could possibly take this just catastrophic step. It's highly unlikely. Yeah. It's unimaginable that it actually would do, because it stands to lose a hell of a lot as well. But if one of Russia's unique selling points is its audacity at the moment as it acts on the world stage, and wow, what could be more audacious than that?
Rafaela, the notion of cybersecurity, the notion of communications, it has been at the forefront of the defence debate for a long time now. Do you take this as a serious threat?
I mean, clearly it's a threat, but then, is it one that they're likely to deploy? It's very hard to sort of envisage it because of the sort of potential ramifications of it. I think, there's sort of two things that struck me from this story. One was, I was reading another interesting story at the weekend in the Washington Post, where they were covering the fact that they'd uncovered documents in sort of, things have been declassified from the Cold War, that showed that back during the Cold War, there were some exercises that NATO was doing, which the Russians were apparently seeing as a potential actual attack rather than just an exercise. And there was a whole question of signaling and how the West had maybe got its signaling a bit wrong in that particular context. And the calculation, actually, that people are now reading in sort of old Soviet declassified files, was that they really thought that they were about to go to nuclear war, and they were sort of ratcheting everything up in that sort of a direction. And this, reading this story, it felt an awful lot like that again. We're kind of veering back into this world where these apocalyptic visions visions are being seen from the other side in movements. And I think it really speaks to the fact that we're not really communicating with each other at all anymore. I think it was an interview with a Russian ambassador or former deputy foreign minister, I can't remember exactly which, in one of the British papers today, where he was saying that, you know, there was really no communication happening between the sort of West and Russia at a sort of any sort of a confidence building or any sort of level whatsoever. It was purely down to sort of cultural exchanges and sort of occasional high-level meetings that we see sort of widely publicized. But a sort of broader conversation about where we're actually doing and what we're actually thinking is completely absent, which is really quite worrying when you think of the ramifications of an incident like this or the potential weapons that we have.
But the way that politics lies, with both of you, this question, you know, there seems very little chance of having that kind of open conversation about what people are. You know, we saw the hunt for these mysterious, you know, submarines, you know, off Sweden last year that kept, you know, the Swedes entertained for like months.
It's a lot like the Loch Ness Monster,
yes,
isn't it?
Photos, actually, but there's something about submarines and what the Russians are up to that has kept people spooked for 50 years. You know, there is, you know, what are the Russians up to down there? What are they up to underneath the Arctic? And perhaps we're just a little bit too fearful. It's like a different world down there. We just don't quite know what's going on.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons what it makes it a wonderful story, and what we can't resist. And I'm sure that the story stands up completely and so on, but we really can't resist looking at this and sort of it harks back to the more dramatic days of the Cold War. But also, I don't think Russia has anything to gain from broad level confidence building dialogue. That's not how it's playing. It's playing its game now, and it seems to be doing, I'm sad to say, pretty well with the strategy it's currently pursuing. It's the West is on the back foot. I mean, it's hard to imagine what NATO could do that would produce a similar story to even that in the New York Times. It's very helpful to be in these situations, to be an autocratic regime, really.
But just linking back a little bit, you know, back to our Syria story, just in that last notion, the top line of the foreign policy here, what's both of your feelings about where Russia stands? Because watching the events unfolding in Syria, and this, you know, this links back to this notion of invasion and going in and what you can do, it's intriguing that the Russians have, you know, had 2 or 3 weeks of, you know, bombings and maybe assisted Assad a little bit, who's taken back a couple of villages. But now they're involved, they're committed, and that's a long-term commitment. But it hasn't really moved the game that much, really, in any direction. So this notion of, you know, all this foreign policy top line, you know, is Russia in a... Yeah, you say he's put the West on the back foot,
yeah.
But I wonder whether that is for a very short term, because suddenly when he sees actually it's not manoeuvred any kind of greater space for him, is that going to be a winning move?
I think it has been. Yeah. It's been characterised by these sort of short-term movements in recent years. I mean, it's a simplistic analysis, but I think Putin seems to be feeling his way and seeing how far he can go and what the reaction is
He's pushing in every single way that he can. You just sort of see where you can push a fissure into the alliance, and it works every time. You know, he did this in Ukraine. He destabilized that country. We're never going to see a sort of Ukraine that we had previously. You've got a government which is in sort of anarchy, and the EU's demonstrated its inability to sort of respond positively or constructively to that. Now he's just doing the same thing in Syria, frankly. He's just sort of throwing some more sand in our eyes and confusing the sort of Western alliance. This fact is sort of probing on the Turkish borders as well. I mean, this is really probing at NATO now, and this is probing at the sort of question of Article 5, and is the alliance really an alliance which is going to stand up against him, or is he able to just sort of cause more chaos amongst it?
The fact is that Putin has taken action in Syria. He's been more decisive than an entire international community for years and years.
Okay, well, that's what he's up to on land and at sea. And just think, if they cut those cables, we'd never know what the Kardashians were up to. You're listening to Midori House, here with me, Andrew Tuck, Raffaello Pantucci and Daniela Peled. Coming up next, we look at the case of a man who travelled from Israel to Syria via a paraglider. And with a woman very possibly set to take on the White House, is it time to do away with the job of being the First Lady?
Kiosk Cafe has arrived in London. From the founders of Monocle comes a newsstand and coffee bar concept inspired by Europe's finest city street kiosks. There's a great selection of magazines and newspapers, of course, including print-on-demand titles from all around the world, making Kiosk Cafe in Paddington a real celebration of the best in print and paper. And there's more. With all-pressed coffee and travel essentials from some of Monocle's favorite brands available too, Kiosk Cafe is the perfect spot for business travelers and visitors to London, as well as print aficionados. Come and visit us and see for yourself. Kiosk Cafe is open for business now from 7 a.m. to 1900 daily at Norfolk Place, moments from Paddington Station. Kiosk Cafe, newsstand and coffee bar. We look forward to welcoming you.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, here on Monocle 24. And still with me are Raffaello Pantucci and Daniela Peled. Well, as one might expect, travelling to Syria isn't the simplest itinerary to arrange. For one man in Israel, however, it was all a relatively simple hurdle to jump. He simply strapped himself to his paraglider and took to the skies. Though accounts of the event initially varied, with some claiming he'd been swept away by the wind, military sources eventually clarified that the man had in fact deliberately travelled across the border to join Syrian rebels. The day before his departure, the so-called Islamic State released a video encouraging Palestinian attacks on Israelis, the second such video in just a week. Now, Benjamin Netanyahu is a tough talking leader, but there's little he can do about incidents like this. Daniela, what's going on here? This is a strange tale which has kind of like really kind of gripped Israel today.
It's a very strange tale. When the details were leaking out, again, you know, there's feverish speculations as to what might have happened. And certainly the video released by Islamic State showing militant, I don't know whether it was dubbed or not, but speaking in properly colloquial, slang-filled Hebrew was... must have been extremely perturbing to people watching in Israel. The number of Palestinian citizens of Israel joining ISIS has been really minimal. I mean, perhaps 40 maximum in recent years, including at least one unfortunate who crossed over and then was executed as a Zionist spy. So they're not producing a significant source of recruitment. But this does come at a very unfortunate time in the middle of this so-called, people calling it a third intifada, the intifada of the knives, where suspicions between Palestinian citizens of Israel and Jewish citizens have never been worse. Feelings have never been worse. And I think the greatest danger here is that it will be used by sections on the right in Israel to play up this idea of the enemy within. That
so it's this notion, this old notion of the fifth columnist, you know, who are we surrounded by, which is always, scared Israelis, and particularly as you say at the moment, these knife attacks, they look at everyone a bit more suspiciously.
It's reached an unprecedented level now, because most of the attacks have been carried out by permanent residents of East Jerusalem, for instance, and some citizens of Israel. And the random nature of it has terrified ordinary people. And you see the prospect, we've already seen, of vigilante attacks and people being killed who have nothing to do with violence.
Raffaello, is this story, is this the journey of one man, is it just an entertaining, oddly bizarre kind of story, or does it say something about, the state of the nation?
I mean, I think that almost every single country that has some sort of a Sunni Muslim population has had some people who are going to fight in Syria and Iraq. I think that's just the sort of the beacon effect of the conflict there and ISIS and what was happening before.
700 people from the UK, supposedly.
Exactly, 700 people from the UK. You have people from Latin America, you've had people from Australia, you've had people from all over the place going. So the fact that we're seeing, 40 or so from Palestine going as well, or Israel, it doesn't entirely surprise me. The fact that this one has crossed over there, in some ways to me that spoke more to one of the sort of curious aspects of the conflict of what we've seen happening in Syria in particular, is its proximity to Israel. And this is the closest that you've had sort of jihadist groups actively taking territory to Israel, which is always the country they're obsessed with, in a very long time. And the fact that we're now seeing people go over in that way, and in some ways it's a kind of reminder of that. Is it emblematic of something larger? I think that in some ways this third intifada that, so-called third intifada that Daniela was talking about, is really quite disturbing, but I think speaks to more something that's happening at home. I don't necessarily know that I would link these two up in the same kind of a way. In some ways, to me, this just feels like, well, there is this huge conflict going on that is having the sort of seismic impact across the sort of Sunni Muslim populations globally and is sort of pulling people in. At the same time, what's happening in Israel is just getting worse and worse and worse. I mean, it's not only knives. I think I was seeing in some of these reports that people are using like screwdrivers. It's just random attacks against anyone who's perceived to be on the other side. Now, we've seen incidents like that happening here in the West, but occasionally and sort of rarely. I mean, the sort of attack of the murder of Lee Rigby back in 2013 sparked off other sort of copycats around Europe. But here we're seeing a lot of these things happen in a really concentrated amount of time. And I think that speaks to a really negative situation, which is only getting worse.
But the political right in Israel, Netanyahu and rightwards, are drawing all kinds of direct links, their comparisons between Hamas and ISIS and Abbas and ISIS. It plays very well into their narrative that all resistance, whether armed or not, is part of the same trajectory of militant Islam taking over the region, and that terrifies the Israeli public.
But what's really fascinating is, in fact, that you are seeing the emergence of some people using ISIS branding in sort of Hamas-controlled areas and saying that they're actually rejecting Hamas because they don't see it as actually a group that's strong enough.
And Hamas is terrified.
It's an extraordinary thing.
Yeah, Hamas has been doing all it can to try and keep the Salafist and ISIS-related elements at bay, which is ironic, acting as Israel's policeman.
Yeah. Well, one final story for the day. About first ladies, because obviously there's a chance that Hillary Clinton is going to be heading to the White House with her husband Bill, and then the notion of the first lady kind of goes out the window. There's a bit of a debate whether he should be the first spouse, or if this whole very notion of first ladies is a kind of a done for concept. Obviously, it's not just the US that has it; France too. Daniel. Well, you're the woman here. Give us a view.
Okay, I'll speak for all women everywhere.
It's a small task, but I think you're up to it.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, I think the idea of the first lady is ridiculous, obsolete, and there's a different role they play in the United States, but certainly here in Britain, looking at the wife of the prime minister and the sort of opprobrium that she's attracted over the years.
But isn't that because we don't give her anything to do? She's just meant to kind of like stand there.
Well, no. I mean, I think it depends how you play it. Cherie
Blair. Some of them are quite active, aren't they?
Cherie Blair was really, really demonised because I think she was perceived as doing too much. Whereas Sarah Brown sort of knew her place and did charity fundraising and work in education and so on. And to be honest, you know, the Obamas have managed to meet that balance in the way that the Clintons probably didn't. And Hillary Clinton's annoyed a lot of people. Going back to Margaret Thatcher, Dennis Thatcher wasn't
he was retired, wasn't he?
He was a very sort of passive and seen as a rather jolly figure who just sat there drinking gin. And so we didn't have a second unelected leader. I think that's possibly what annoys people, apart from the element of misogyny. But the idea that, you know, you buy one and you get two.
Well, I don't think we really know what we want the role of the spouse, the partner to be. You know, Angela Merkel keeps her husband kind of tucked away, never in public view. And I think he enjoys that.
Well, he's a chemistry professor or something, if I recall. Right?
Yeah, and but I think, you know, they deliberately have a process where, you know, they're not keen on putting their leaders up as these kind of, you know, charismatic leaders. So keep the husband out the way kind of works reasonably well there. But when you look at the Obamas, you know, again, maybe it has been the role of like food and cooking and health and things. But, you know, Michelle Obama has been oddly more popular, you think, than her husband in many quarters over the last 4, 5, 6 years, certainly, of his presidencies.
But so, she's got less involved in some of the legislative stuff. I think the reason that Hillary Clinton attracted so much negative attention was there was the healthcare bill, if I recall, that she was trying to push through.
Yeah, but is that because Daniel says you don't want them to be too smart? You want them to be slightly, you know, a bit of an adornment.
To be fair, I think that goes for whatever gender the spouse is.
But when we look at Hillary Clinton, if she does return to the White House, what would be the role, do you think, of Bill?
Well, not very much. I mean, to be honest, he doesn't look very well these days. You know, I think we'd be quite glad that him to just sit on the sidelines, literally sit on the sidelines, and just take a very sort of laid back.
But it would be complicated bringing back someone into the White House who had been a president, you know, who then started talking about policy, who then seemed to be that influential. It's like two presidents for the price of one, isn't it? So a bit of a Walmart deal.
Yeah, absolutely. But
a
you know what?
Off, right?
A bug off.
Buy one, get one.
I think there are a few people who may be using that phrase as well. But, you know, do you think that he should have any role if he came back to the White House?
Well, I think he'd continue to manage the Clinton Global Foundation, which, if I understood, does some fairly good charitable work around the world. And that's fine. I think in terms of policy, I don't know, one gets the feeling that, you know, he seems to be taking quite an active protective position and stepping back and recognizing that this is now her moment to shine, and he's kind of had his moment in the sun. And as Daniela said, he does look an older man these days.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Raffaello Pantucci and Daniela Peled, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. Today's show, well, it was produced by Ben Rylan. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, by Clara Strunk, and by Antonia Martz-Heuser, and also by Tate Turnbull. And our studio manager, well, that was, of course, Toby Hammond. For the next half an hour, Carlotta Rebello will be keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist. There are lots of great tunes. I imagine a few from Portugal, knowing her anyway. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Culture Show with Mr. Robert Bound. But for me, Andrew Tuck, it's time to say thank you and goodbye.